Milk is available from local farms, and farmers benefit when they can sell it at a full retail price. Yet their sales are restricted to 40 gallons per day. That means that no more than about 80 families per farm can get healthy by consuming a half a gallon of raw milk per day. Oh, and there's more. The milk is to be sold only for liquid consumption. No butter from that cream, no raw milk in your homemade bread, and no homemade cheese from that raw milk. Let's create more freedom now and enjoy the unity to help and support one another when we need it most. Find out more about me at Dexter4VT.com and vote for Dexter LeFevre on November 6th, paid for by Dexter for Senate Committee.
The year end is approaching quicker than you might think, and that means there are unique opportunities to help you move your family towards your financial goals. I'm David Babick, your Waitsfield Edward Jones financial advisor. What you do before the last page is torn from this year's calendar can make a big difference in working towards your goals. Let's work together to make next year's finances even better. Call me today at 802-496-5533 and take care of your financial future. That's 496-5533. Edward Jones, making sense of investing. Member SIPC.
Alrighty, 244-1777 is our local number. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. We head over to Albany. Let's give a nice warm radio from Mount Welcome this morning to Al Hicks. Al is one of those participating in the 44th Annual Symposium on Bat Research. And Al is a retired state mammalogist and bat expert for the New York Department of Environmental Conservation, now runs a private bat contracting service, and he's kind enough to join us on the line. Good morning, Al. How's it going?
Good morning. Things are going very well here. We're finally getting some of the autumn rains that we have long been looking for.
So. Oh, my gosh. You're one of those people that actually likes rain, huh? Okay.
Well, it's good to have things wet going into the winter.
All right, your bat contracting service, that means I can call you up and hire a bunch of bats to come and, like, clean my house or something? What's going on with that?
Well, no, basically, we help agencies do projects that they simply don't have the staff or time to do themselves, and we also help companies that have projects in areas that might have endangered species on the premises, so we do surveys to determine if they're present or absent, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's more or less an extension of what I had done for the previous 30-some years, trying to make the world a little bit better in a small way.
So. Yeah, there you go. So you've been actually doing, with your bat contracting service, you've actually been helping out here in Vermont. Talk about the work that you did in Vermont here recently.
Sure. Well, the work that we're doing in Vermont recently really started as a result of a disease that arrived from Europe and hit the Northeast in 2006. And up until that year, bat populations across the entire Northeast were doing very well. In fact, most of the effort that I had spent in the last 6, 8, 10 years of my career were accumulating enough information so that we could justify delisting the Indiana bat because it was doing better and better, and we had never wanted to have species on the list that didn't deserve protection. So we were working hard to make that happen, and then all of a sudden this disease, what we call white nose syndrome, arrived on the scene out of nowhere, and these populations of bats that had been increasing for decades and decades crashed overnight. Within a couple of years, we had lost probably 90% of the bats overall in the state of New York and New England and Vermont, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, the losses are probably 99%. And this all happened in just a couple of years. So the project we've been doing in Vermont is at a very special place in the bat world. It's called Aeolus Cave. It's near East Dorset, Vermont. And this is a site that has long been recognized as a major, major place where bats hibernate in the Northeast, going back as far as Hal Hitchcock, who was a professor at Middlebury College, and Donald Griffin, who was associated with Hal. I believe he was one of Hal's students at one time, and ended up at Harvard. He was a very famous mammalogist. Anyway, they had done work up there that demonstrated that the bats that winter in this one cave spend their summers as far away as Cape Cod, the lower Hudson River Valley of New York, up near the borders of Canada, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, eastern New York,
wow.
Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. So this is the probably the most important place in the whole Northeast. And the one downside is it's the access is so tight that it's never been fully explored. People never got to where the bats were actually hibernating. So we have somewhere in the vicinity of 300,000 that were wintering there when the disease hit, and huge numbers died, probably 90% or more. It was just a terrible thing to see. The floor was absolutely carpeted with bats wherever you walked.
Wow.
And now, some 8 years later, we're trying to determine if the bats that are there are surviving, or if they're continuing to die. And we don't want animals. We don't want to relax our concern for any species if numbers are continuing to decline after this disease. So we have a project going on where we're marking animals in the fall, and we just finished. And we'll be coming back in the spring to see how many of those animals survive the winter and come out.
Wow. Talking with Al Hicks, he used to work for the New York Department of Environmental Conservation. He's an expert in bats, talking about white nose syndrome. So what I'm hearing you saying is that nobody really knows if the population is bottomed out here?
Yeah, well, keep in mind, we have 9 species of bats here in the Northeast. 3 of them migrate south, and so they're never here during the wintertime, and they never really go into caves and mines, certainly in any numbers. Those 3, the red, hoary, and silver-haired, are now pretty much gone from Vermont. They're in more southern regions where it doesn't get really cold for long periods of time, so they don't have to hibernate like our other bats. And this disease is a fungal disease that only attacks the bats while they're hibernating, okay? Because while bats are hibernating, their immune system is shut down, and they just can't protect themselves in the way that they can during the summer months. Mm. So a bat that's infected with this fungus in the summer will be fine. He can fight it off. But in the wintertime, it's not so fine. And the response varies between species. One species, the big brown bat, which is one of the 2 species that is regularly encountered in buildings, they seem to be doing fine. We don't have any evidence that they've suffered a dramatic decline. On the other end is the northern bat or northern long-eared bat, and they have declined by in excess of 99% to the point where there's so few of them that we can't even monitor the survivors in a way that will tell us if they're stable or still declining. So that species is in really big trouble. Mm. No question about it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what are the consequences of losing a population like that?
Well, a population like that, the bats from Aeolus Cave, they would eat in the summertime somewhere between a third and a half of their body weight every night in insects. They weigh 8 to 10 grams, so we'll say 4 grams a night, 300,000 times 4 is a lot of insects.
Yeah.
So that's one aspect of it. But it's really a bigger issue of the quality of life that we have on this planet. And you have segments of the population that have always recognized that we have a duty to our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren to leave them a planet, leave them a state, in the case of Vermont, that's at least as good as the one that they inherited, if not better. Okay? And that takes many different forms. But this conservation ethic, understanding that there's more to life than the football game on Monday night. There's more to life than going to the mall, and that the natural world makes us what we are. People come to Vermont in the fall to see the splendor of the autumn leaves and such, and that's an affirmation of how important the natural world is to us in a fundamental way. So that portion of the population has always been there. It's been back in time with Teddy Roosevelt and company. They pushed the conservation message that we have today. They created the national parks. They created the Adirondack Park and the Green Mountains National Forest and the Whites and all these places that people can recreate. Part of that is the hunting heritage that we have and the fishing heritage and the people that go out bird watching and all appreciate and understand there's more than just the dollar value that you can assign to a different species. Unfortunately, there's also the segment of the population that is me first, me today, and I don't really care about tomorrow. And one tiny manifestation of that would be, oh, we don't care what happens to bats. You expand that out, we don't care what happens to the planet. We don't care about things like global warming, even though the evidence is piling up around us that it's going to destroy the lives of our children and our grandchildren. They simply don't care. So it's a struggle between these two forces in our society, and unfortunately, the me now and give me the resources that the land can provide. They're winning in most of these battles, and this is just a tiny portion of that.
Why do you say that in this? Why do you say that in this, particularly with this bat question?
Of how
that the me firsts are winning here.
Well, no. The me first would be the ones that would say, "Oh, we don't need to be concerned about endangered species."
No, I understand. Why do you think they're winning? What makes you say that?
Look at the. let's point to the big one: global warming. When that issue first came to the floor, in a convincing way, to where. You know, the people that really knew what was going on, it was obvious to them that there's a problem, and they presented that information to the people that run this country and said, we're putting our children's lives at risk. We need to act now. I thought at the time, naively, that people would be lining up in droves to, yes, let's take care of this problem. But in fact, the absolute opposite had happened. Large forces in this country spent multi-millions of dollars to convince our elected officials not to act, and we're no better off, and we're losing ground in the battle of global warming, and that's one that's going to have direct consequences to everything we do. So if we can't win that one, if people aren't willing to stand up in masses to fight in front, little battles like taking care of the northern long-eared bat, they don't stand a chance in the long term.
Talking with Al Hicks, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Al Hicks was with the New York Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm sorry, go ahead, you were going to say something else.
No, I can't remember what I'm going to say 1 minute to the next.
Okay, all right.
So we'll let you lead.
All right. Can a population of animals be revived when you get down to 99.99%+ are gone?
Oh yeah, yeah. There's many examples of species coming back from near total collapse. The problem is, you have to have an environment where the recruitment, the birth of animals is greater than the losses from mortality. And until you create that situation on a very long-term basis, you're going to continue to lose ground. And with some of our species, a little brown bat is a good example, and that was always the primary bat at Aeolus Cave, and that's the primary one that we're studying now. There is some evidence to suggest that species may have hit bottom and is now in a situation where it's starting to recover, albeit very slowly. That's the reason for the study is to confirm that is indeed happening.
Mm-hmm.
So even if your recruitment, addition to the population is fairly modest, as long as you're adding to the population on an annual basis, you'll gain ground.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, you're sunk.
Mm-hmm. What are you hoping happens at this conference in Albany? What's best case scenario for you here next couple of days?
Okay, well, there's several different or two main groups of people in the bat world. And this is the North American Symposium on Bat Research. This has been going on now for 44 years. And it's an annual gathering of the academic community. And some of these people are working on the white nose problem, but some of them are working on other things, just natural history things and physiology and, you know, how is it that bats do this, how is it bats do that, that kind of thing. Just a general investigation into all aspects of bats. So this is the academic world, and there's about 400 people here that are mostly students in their associated faculty that are presenting the work that they're doing. So it's nurturing the next generation of bat biologists and biologists in general in the academic world. There are many people here that are involved with the white nose stuff, but the meat and potatoes of the white nose stuff comes from the agency end of things, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife, New York, all the different states and the federal agencies that actually are, their mandate is to protect these species. Mm-hmm. So that's a different group and that's a different meeting. But this is the academic end of the bat world.
And is there any better understanding, any better breakthrough on how and why this happened or not?
Oh, yeah, we pretty much know why it happened. This is a fungus that has been in Europe for probably thousands of years and has whatever it was going to do to the bat populations of Europe, it's long since done it. We have no idea if species disappeared completely or how many species disappeared completely as a result of the occurrence of this disease. But now because of how quickly we can move around the world from one place to another, whether it's we have the ability to move diseases from one continent to the next in an incredibly rapid pace.
Kind of like Ebola, right?
Well, Ebola is an example, but there's hundreds and hundreds of examples right here in the Northeast. One of the early ones that was recognized was American chestnut, a tree that provided all kinds of, you know, the chestnuts roasting on an open fire. That's the chestnuts that they were talking about. A beautiful tree, great timber, all kinds of aspects that were positive with this. And it essentially disappeared as a commercial tree around the turn of the century because of the introduction of fungus. Mm-hmm. The Dutch elm disease that hit portions of Western New York starting in the 60s and has now pretty much wiped out the American elm here in Eastern New York. I'm not sure of the status in Vermont, is another good example. these carp that have recently been introduced to the Mississippi drainage and now apparently are invading the Great Lakes, zebra mussels, all of these species are things that are being shuffled around the world in a matter of hours.
Right.
And if people don't appreciate the negative consequences of moving these things around, then more and more species around the world will continue to be lost.
Thank you for your time this morning. I really appreciate
it,
Al.
Well, thank you very much.
Al Hicks was one time with the New York Department of Environmental Conservation. He's one of the academics and researchers over at a conference over in Albany, the 44th Annual Symposium on Bat Research. It's going on today, and it'll be running through Saturday if you're interested. I'm just trying to see if there's a website here, but... All right, if I find one, I'll pass along to you. We're going to squeeze in just a real quick break here before the top of the hour. We'll be back in a moment.
Used, pre-owned.
Less new.